I next met with Dr. Eunice Kwok, second author on the plenary meeting presentation of the oral ALK inhibitor crizotinib in EML4-ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer. Dr. Kwok told me about the fascinating background to this landmark data set.
The EML4-ALK story is a very interesting one. We happen to be involved in a trial of an inhibitor of both ALK and MET called PF0234-1066. So it's currently in phase 1 clinical trials. And this trial initially started out as a standard phase 1 dose escalation study to look at toxicity and maximum tolerated dose. And because it is a targeted agent, we actually were particularly interested in its activity against MET, because there are certain tumors that seem to suggest MET might be another oncogene addiction situation. So for instance, in a cell culture model, gastric cancer cell lines that have amplified MET are very sensitive to small molecule inhibitors of MET. So we kind of went into this trial with that idea to try to explore this drug PF1066 in the setting of MET amplification. However, in the course of the phase 1, the Japanese group headed by Dr. Mano had published a nice paper in Nature that really discovered or described for the first time the EML4-ALK rearrangement in non-small cell lung cancer. And we were actually able to identify a patient who had this ALK rearrangement and get them onto the phase 1 trial even while we were still dose escalating. So that patient actually went on trial and did very well and really gave us the first clue that this drug, 1066, was a very potent inhibitor of ALK clinically, but also that this entity, EML4-ALK, really is an example of oncogene addiction within non-small cell lung cancers.
And can you talk a little bit more biologically about where the oncogene addiction is and how that correlates, if at all, with what's going on with EGFR mutations?
So the ALK rearrangements, those cancers appear to be independent of cancers that have EGFR mutations. So if you look at non-small cell lung cancers and you look at the EGFR mutant population, those patients tend to be female of Asian ethnic descent, have a non-smoking or light smoking history, and tend to have adenocarcinoma as their non-small cell lung cancer histology. So some of those features are actually common with the ALK patients. So adenocarcinoma histology and light or non-smoking history tends to also be the demographic feature of patients who have ALK gene rearrangement. But if you look at that group of patients chosen phenotypically for those features, and you actually go and sequence their EGFR gene status or look at their ALK status or even look at their KRAS status, Alice Shaw has published relatively recently in JCO a nice paper, as have other people, showing that EGFR mutation, ALK gene rearrangement, and KRAS mutation are really mutually exclusive in non-small cell lung cancers.
The thing that I think I remember about MET is, isn't there in some way it's related to EGFR mutation cases where there's resistance to an EGFR TKI? Somehow the MET comes in there?
Right. So Jeffrey Engelman has shown that one mechanism of resistance in EGFR mutant lung cancers to small molecule therapy is the development of MET amplification. And so by the development of MET amplification, the tumors bypass the reliance on EGFR and the ability to be inhibited solely by drugs such as erlotinib.
Anything new in terms of EGFR mutations that's come out, you know, in the last year or two that you think docs in practice should know about?
Well, I think it's something that we've known or had evidence for a long time, but really the pivotal trial, the IPASS trial recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think pretty much ices the cake as far as proving the role of epidermal growth factor receptor mutations and therapy with small molecule inhibitors such as gefitinib. Those patients clearly did much better. The EGFR mutant patients did better with gefitinib therapy. Patients who did not have mutations in EGFR did not do well with gefitinib. And so I think that it really sort of drives home the point that we need to know the molecular status of patients before we go about trying to decide their treatment regimen. And that even though demographic features such as non-smoking history or female, gender, or even Asian ethnicity are good first cuts at trying to enrich patients for various molecular features, we really need to actually take the extra step of defining the molecular abnormality in order to best provide our patients with the best chance of responding to a targeted agent.
And, you know, it also, I think, brings up the practical issue, again, for an oncologist in practice in terms of, up to now, I don't really think there's been that much testing done, even for EGFR mutations. And based, you know, on IPASS, as you've just said, it seems like you really need to know the result if you want to make a decision about, I guess, a non-smoking person with adenocarcinoma. Do you see this becoming like ER and HER2 and breast cancer, that it's going to be sort of routine to get at least an EGFR mutation, maybe EML4 ALK done on every patient or every patient who's a non-smoker with adenocarcinoma?
Right. I mean, I think that would be the ideal situation. I think you're right. Our colleagues in the breast world are much farther advanced than most of the rest of us in terms of including all of that molecular testing into their general way of thinking about how they treat their cancers. But clearly, where we are, certainly we go through and we have a great lab that has the ability to test for these various genetic modifications or abnormalities. Clearly, it's going to take a while before this is something that can become commonplace in the community setting. But, you know, I think things move quickly. For instance, in colorectal cancer, KRAS testing was right. not something we did routinely until very recently. And now it has to be part of our decision-making process.
It was amazing. I mean, ASCO 2008 plenary session, Eric Van Cutsen stands up there and does it. And like within a couple of weeks, practice had changed.
Exactly.
It was amazing. Do you think that at this point, certainly I guess you can make a very strong argument about EGFR mutation testing, but in a patient who's mutation negative, what about getting an EML4 ALK done? How do you get it done and should it be done?
So I think the results of the phase 1 trial are very promising. We haven't even gotten to that point yet, but patients that we've treated so far, there's a response rate in the 60-plus range. And we, all the members who have been involved in this phase 1 clinical trial, have seen examples of really just tremendous improvements in patient clinical status. I think we really owe it to our patients to be able to offer them drugs such as this if their tumor makeup is such that it seems like a reasonable option. And, you know, at this point, EML4 ALK, that's a very early test and treatment path for patients that really, I think, can only be pursued at the level of a clinical trial. But the phase 1 clinical trial is going on in multiple sites across the world, and the phase 3 trial has just started. So there are ways to get patients tested, I think, via these clinical trials.
Can you talk a little bit more about what we know about this BIBW compound and how it's being evaluated?
Well, the interesting thing about BIBW, as well as a class of other similar agents, is that it's an irreversible inhibitor of HER2 and EGFR, unlike lapatinib, which is a reversible inhibitor. And so I had actually been involved, as well as a lot of other investigators, on some preclinical studies that suggested that perhaps an irreversible inhibitor of EGFR could be a better inhibitor of EGFR mutant lung cancer cell lines, and ultimately lung cancers, that had acquired resistance to reversible inhibitors such as erlotinib and gefitinib. And so one of the ways, I think, in which BIBW is being looked at is in lung cancer, both as an inhibitor of EGFR mutant lung cancer in general, but also as an inhibitor of perhaps EGFR mutant lung cancer that has potentially developed resistance.
What about the HER2 aspect of that in terms of lung cancer? What do we know about the incidence of HER2 positivity?
So I think in lung cancer, from my understanding, the more interesting subsets of the HER2 population are those who have HER2 gene mutation as opposed to amplification, and that is a very rare population, somewhere below 5%.
The BIBW compound is a TKI, correct?
Mm-hmm, right.
So what about safety tolerability? Is it similar to the other EGFR TKIs?
Right. I think similar to other EGFR TKIs, there are side effects such as diarrhea and rash, but it has been studied quite extensively in the phase 1 setting and is being studied quite a bit in the phase 2 setting at this point. So it can be given at doses that are well tolerated.
What do we know about the mechanisms of resistance that develop to EGFR TKIs with the EGFR mutations and the theory about why BIBW or something like that would be effective?
Right. So the resistance that's seen in the setting of EGFR mutant lung cancer treated with drugs such as erlotinib or gefitinib, the acquired resistance can take the form of a couple of different mechanisms, one of which appears to be the acquisition of a T790M mutation, which is a resistance mutation that is seen in some patients who have become resistant to erlotinib or gefitinib. And then the other mechanism of resistance is the MET amplification story, which we had spoken about earlier. And it's interesting because the T790M mutation is a little bit of a complicated story, but it doesn't seem to be exactly a matter of blocking the ability of the drug to gain access to the active site of the receptor, because there are actually families that have been described who have germline T790M mutations. This was a nice paper published a few years ago by Daphne Bell and her group. The T790M actually does seem to actually confer some increased risk of developing lung cancer in and of itself. How the irreversible inhibitor actually may impact the ability of a resistant molecule is not completely clear, at least certainly in patients. The hypothesis has not been fully borne out, but I think is certainly an area of active investigation.
Let's talk a little bit more about the clinical research and the study that's been done so far looking at this PF compound and the EML4-ALK. And maybe we can kind of get into that by talking about your 45-year-old woman who I guess was treated on the study. Can you kind of present her and how she presented and what happened?
Sure. So this is a 45-year-old woman initially presented at that age with a history of cough and hemoptysis. She had had no smoking history, had never smoked in her life. And as often happens, especially with someone so young, it was presumed that she had something like pneumonia. And so she was treated with antibiotics, but did not actually improve significantly on chest x-ray, even after a prolonged course of treatment. She subsequently underwent additional imaging, which revealed a 4-centimeter opacity in the left lower lobe on CT scan. And a biopsy was performed, which revealed adenocarcinoma of the lung. This was a case where the tumor was found early enough that she underwent a lobectomy and had negative lymph nodes, 0 out of 21, involved with cancer. And so she had stage T2N0M0 cancer and received adjuvant chemotherapy and was hoping to be well. She had, in the course of this time, also been tested for epidermal growth factor mutation, and her status was wild type. So about a year and a half later, she started to develop some suspicious nodules, which were followed out for some additional time. And unfortunately, the additional imaging revealed that she did have PET avidity and evidence of recurrent disease as proven by biopsy. And then she was also becoming more symptomatic at that time as well. She started on a course of erlotinib, but in the few months during which she had started this treatment, she actually had been tested by our lab run by John Iafredi for ALK rearrangement, and turned out her tumor had ALK rearrangement. And so she was screened for the PF 1066 trial and was found to be eligible. 17 months later, she's on trial.
And has the tumor actually responded?
It has. She had, if you look at her CT scan, she had a very sort of diffuse distribution of tumor across, especially, I believe it was the left side of her lung. And if you look at the CT scan, just even after the first restaging, 2 months after starting treatment, it's remarkable. It just goes to nothing that's visible. And she clinically feels great, and she's been very active with her young family. It's been really very rewarding to see patients such as this who've done well on the drug.
And what's the schedule of how it's administered, and what's been seen in terms of safety and tolerability issues, and how did she do in terms of safety and tolerability?
So the drug is administered daily. It's an oral drug. It is being given twice a day at this point in time at 250 milligrams. And the side effects, for the most part, have been very mild nausea and some vomiting. Those are the most common side effects. And some of that can be modified with the intake of a small amount of food, for instance. The other side effects that we have been seeing include some lower extremity edema, and some visual symptoms, which are described as kind of trails of light that follow objects, especially when people are waking up first thing in the morning, or basically any transitions from dark to light or light to dark. But those side effects really seem to be very well tolerated for the most part by people. Fatigue actually was another side effect that was seen during dose escalation and actually was one of the dose escalating toxicities. But I think the interesting thing is that some of these patients are so symptomatic when they get on trial that because of the improvement in their disease status, they actually feel much better overall, because even if they might be having some of these side effects from treatment, they're just feeling overall so much better from the standpoint of their disease that the side effects from the drug really seem relatively minor.
Now, what about this woman? Did she have any of those issues?
She had a little bit of mild nausea, which was well controlled. Again, small amounts of food or anti-nausea drugs were helpful. She's had some very minimal edema and occasional eyesight symptoms, which actually seem to have gotten more and more mild as time went on. And she's hiking, she's doing the things that she normally likes to do, and really is experiencing a very good quality of life.
Now, what about safety issues? I think LFT abnormalities or hepatic toxicity has been seen.
Right. So on occasion, we have seen in the dose escalation phase of the trial, patients who have developed elevations of, in particular, the ALT. In a few patients, these increases have been dose limiting. For some of them, it appears that rechallenge with lower doses of drugs can be successful in trying to keep the patient on drug while trying to minimize the effects of the LFTs. The LFT elevations have all been reversible upon withdrawal of the drug. And again, it's very hard to predict which are the people who might have some of these LFT abnormalities. It happens rarely, and it tends to happen towards the beginning of the second cycle. But again, they are reversible. And for at least some of the patients who've experienced this, we've been able to sort of work around it by reduction of the dose of drug.
What about efficacy? I remember the waterfall plot and really being struck by that in terms of, it seemed like at least in the ASCO presentation, almost everybody had tumor shrinkage. Where are we right now in terms of how many patients have been treated and what fraction have responded?
The trial is ongoing, and so the number of patients treated is always an increasing number that I don't even know the completely accurate number of at this moment in time. But as of December, there were about 64 patients, I think, who had received drug, and 50 of them were evaluable for response. And at that time, there was an objective response rate of 64%. In terms of stable disease plus response, 90% of patients had derived either stable disease or response. And so actually very few patients are not responding to drug at all.
And where right now are things in terms of development of this agent, not just in lung cancer, but in cancer in general?
So again, the phase one trial is ongoing. We continue to look for patients who may have other tumors that are dependent upon the ALK pathway, tumors such as anaplastic large cell lymphoma, for instance, or perhaps some types of sarcoma. There's a very rare sarcoma called inflammatory myoblastic tumor that is dependent upon the ALK signaling pathway. And then in addition, we're also still looking for tumors that have MET gene abnormalities, either amplification or mutation. Ravi Salji is particularly interested in MET mutation in non-small cell lung cancer. I'm particularly interested, as well as one of my co-investigators in Korea, in gastric cancers that have MET amplification. So the phase one trial is still exploring other tumor types that may be dependent upon MET and ALK pathways. As far as the lung cancers, the ALK-positive lung cancers, the development of the drug has really moved more now from phase one to phase three. The phase three trial is currently accruing. It is looking at the drug PF in patients with ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer in the second line and comparing it to patients who are receiving chemotherapy.
So it's kind of a second-line IPASS?
Yes, I guess you could say that. Except for one thing, in IPASS, the patients were not all prospectively found to have EGFR mutations,
right,
whereas
right.
These patients all have right. ALK abnormalities.
Right, right. They were just picked up phenotypically
right.
And then afterwards, right? What's the current estimate in terms of the fraction of non-small cell that has this ALK fusion and the fraction of people who are non- or oligosmokers who have it?
So in terms of an unselected population of non-small cell lung cancers, various groups have reported percentages of anywhere from a little over 1% of lung cancers to up to 6 to 7% of lung cancers. But again, I think we've found, and particularly Alice Shaw has described, that if you look at a selected population of patients, particularly with a non- or light smoking history and an adenocarcinoma histology, you can greatly enrich for patients who might have this ALK abnormality. And so in that setting, if you just look for things like non-smoking history or light smoking history and adenocarcinoma, you can find perhaps, I think Alice's recent work suggests a 13% incidence of ALK fusion genes. And if you sequence patients for EGFR as well, and you're able to put aside or account for the EGFR mutant patients and remove those from your patients of interest, the population of ALK patients could be as high as about 33%, I believe. So if you are able to analyze the genes that seem to be most likely to be abnormal within this, again, demographically selected group of people, which as far as we know, the demographics seem to favor adenocarcinoma and non-smoking or light smoking history as the selection factors, then I think it's actually a very feasible possibility that you can prospectively identify these patients and put them on appropriate therapy.
Even though it's kind of early with this, I mean, still it sounds exciting enough that patients maybe want to get involved with the trial if they might be eligible. And docs, I'm sure, will be thinking, how do I not miss this? I get a little bit nervous about adenocarcinoma histologically even. I mean, can you just say if they don't have adenocarcinoma, they're not going to have either one of these EGFR or EML4 ALK?
Well, I think it's always hard to say. We're in early days of the ALK story. Our data so far would suggest that adenocarcinoma is the most common histology by far. But then you always run into situations where either the histology microscopically is a little bit unclear, or we have had a few patients with ALK positivity that have had greater than a 10-pack year smoking history. So there are always exceptions to the rule. And I think that for any patient who one might suspect, particularly if they're on the young side, because that actually tends to be one of the demographic features that travels with EML4 ALK positivity, then it's worth trying, I think, to look into testing.
What about other means to test for both of these subsets, and specifically circulating tumor cells and, I guess, circulating DNA also?
Well, as far as at least using, if we start with formalin fixed paraffin embedded tissues, there are two ways that tumors are being tested. One is by using a break apart FISH assay. The other is by trying to go into the realm of immunohistochemistry, because that would make testing a little more straightforward for various sites to do. And then as far as going into the realm of circulating tumor cells, I think that would be the great hope for technology such as circulating tumor cells. Again, Massachusetts General Hospital, there's a big interest in circulating tumor cells and trying to identify these cells using a microfluidic technology. And the advantage of that technology is, yes, you may be able to molecularly study tumor cells from patients just by drawing peripheral blood. And so, you know, that's certainly not something that we can do on a widespread basis at this point, but somewhere down the line, that would be an ideal use for something like circulating tumor cells.
I'm trying to remember from that big New England Journal paper about this, were they able to actually detect EGFR mutations that way?
They were.
And what about EML4 ALK? Has that been looked at?
As far as I know, there may be a few cases where that was looked at. I'm not aware of any significant database, but I believe that there's some evidence of being able to find it using circulating tumor cells. I think in practice, it's always a little bit more difficult. I mean, I've been in an academic institution during training and practice and have always had the luxury of having a very involved clinical lab that is interested in research questions as well. And I think that it's true that having access to a testing facility is sort of the biggest challenge in the community setting. But I'm sure that academic institutions involved in these various trials, for instance, of PF1066, are happy to see patients who are interested in getting tested and then possibly going on protocol if they are indeed positive for the ALK fusion gene.